Accession number 9738, Reel 4.
That's Reel 4.
We arrived in that camp in New Stuttgart. Excuse me. 700 people. And after a short space of time, I would think about a month or so, we were left only 280. As you know, the rest were beaten to death to get the gold fillings and sell the food rations on the black market by the German authorities in charge of that camp. Now, from there, eventually the Allies were approaching, so they had to send us to Gotha. Gotha is in the center of Germany, and at first we were actually in some houses in the very town center of this place, which was wonderful to be in a house for a change, you know what I mean, and to have a proper roof over your head, and to, it felt a bit better somehow. Although the food rations were no better, but at least it felt better. We felt like almost half civilized. But of course, we didn't stay there very long. They eventually, as soon as they had bunkers which kept ammunition in the woods, as soon as they had those empty, they pushed us into those bunkers, and we stayed in the bunkers. And from there, again, the Allies were approaching. So the order came through, we must be taken out straight away at night. And we had to run through their tracks and all kind of back roads, back paths and all that in order to get us, because the main roads were actually full of retreating Germans. And in fact, some lorries, when we did see a road nearby or had to cross a road, the lorries were burning and they were just waiting, the Germans were waiting with their anti-tank weapons for the Allies to come in. And of course, we at least enjoyed that. You know, we could see that the German war was finished, and we knew it was only a question of time. But we realized, we asked ourselves a question: are we going to survive at this very last minute, this very late hour? Of course, some people did try and run away from the columns, especially when we passed a forest. Some perhaps got away. We never know that, and then most of them got shot. We marched and marched all night, and then we marched again the following day. The Germans themselves got tired and they had to be replaced. They couldn't keep up the march, but we had to. They got food on the way, they got water, they got tea, they got everything. We got nothing. So eventually, as I said, came nightfall, and that was enough. Even they, with all the replacements they had, they couldn't keep up any further, the Germans. So they decided on one big field, we're going to stay overnight. I think we carried some carried blankets with us, I think, yes. We lay down on that field, and the Germans were sitting around this group, and we're lying there at night. And all night you had shooting. I thought to myself, they're shooting that to make sure that nobody gets any ideas of lifting his head up or trying to escape or get any ideas. So in other words, so we should keep quiet. In the morning, roll call, we got up. I said to my friend, naively I said, what's the matter with these people? Why won't they get up? They're shouting. He said, don't be a fool, these are people who are dead. Now, these are people lying next to you, for example, here, there, anywhere. They were just shooting at random into the crowd to reduce the number. So even at this very late hour, when the war was completely finished, they still had this stupidity, this ruthlessness, this criminality in their nature, and the hatred of us, to kill people. There was no need for it. Hitler didn't have any time to think about all that. The orders were already not given anymore at that time. And so you can see these people had initiative and they just took delight in murdering people. We marched afterwards, and on that subsequent march, which I mentioned before, I nearly gave up and friends of mine saved me. Anyway, we eventually marched into Buchenwald. And Buchenwald was very overcrowded at that time because they were taking people in from all over, little camps from all over the place. Again, the Allies were approaching Buchenwald. So again, Buchenwald had to be evacuated. We mustn't be liberated. Under any circumstances, the enemies must not be saved. That was their policy. Did a very, very bitter end. Now, from there, and don't forget, the German railway lines, the German trains and the rolling stock was absolutely full chock-a-block with their own army going backwards and forwards. So how they could possibly occupy the vital rolling stock, moving these wretched people backwards and forwards, is beyond my belief. This was completely illogical. Anyway, they eventually decided to put us on a train, on open wagons, a coal wagon train, you know. And we put 100 people to a wagon. Now, you know, 100 people to a wagon is exceptionally overcrowded. And came at night, of course, it's just enough standing room, but came at night, of course, you can't lie down, it's impossible. You only have to lie one on top of the other. So you can imagine, you got no food, no water, and 100 people to a wagon. You were, every morning we had so many people dead. And of course the dead bodies were dragged out, and as soon as we stopped somewhere and pushed onto this platform and finished. And in some places where we stopped, we were so starving. We ate, for example, our own shoes. We ate, some people actually ate human flesh. I think those were more courageous and sensible. What flesh was left, because there was hardly any flesh left on us. And also bark of trees, and if they saw any leaf anywhere, whatever it was, whatever they could find, everything was eaten. The Germans, of course, they got their food. They got food delivered to them. And every wagon had this German assessment watching over us. And if anybody lifted his head up, for example, at night, say, I want to go to the toilet, because no toilet facilities of any kind, he would be banged on his head or said, look, if you don't put your head down, I'll shoot you immediately. And some were shot. And we were there on that train journey for 3 weeks. So you can imagine how many people perished on that journey. The cold at night. And the terrible suffering, the battles used to take place every night to lie down, because you had to lie down. And whoever was stronger lay on top of the other.
And so there were hundreds on this train?
Oh, thousands. Oh, thousands, yes. It was a big train. And eventually, an order came out. One day, it says, Jews separated, to be separated, you see. And I went along, I don't know why I went along, perhaps I shouldn't have done, I don't know, I went with the Jews. You're always frightened, you see, in case they'll find out that you're always hoping, you're still hoping, although you know from experience, after all these years, that the whole thing was a facade, you know, it was a farce. They were always trying to delude you, to mislead you, in order to make you believe that you're taken somewhere for work, not for death. But nevertheless, you want to believe in hope. So I went. And the actual fact, what the intention was, we were heading for Theresienstadt, that's Czechoslovakia. And what they wanted to do is get off all the Jews and finish off all the remnants of Jews they had. And kill off all the Jews there. In fact, they built a special crematorium not far from Theresienstadt in the mountains. Fortunately, that was never used. And anyway, it was the reason why it was never used, it was so close to the end of the war that the commandant of the Theresienstadt ghetto, or camp, whatever you call it, he was very shrewd, and he approached the Red Cross and told them of the plan, And they said, and he said, look, he said, I've got to have sanctuary now, because if the German authorities find out about it, I'll be finished off. But what he wanted to do really save his own skin. But by the same way, of course, he managed to save a few lives as well, of our lives. And the Red Cross took over the place. And that was only a matter of days before the liberation. I don't know how many days, 3 or 4 days, I'm not sure. And the whole thing, of course, the whole plan was never carried out. But in the ghetto of Theresienstadt, of course, the Germans must have poisoned the water with bacteria. So we got typhoid, very severe typhoid. And people were dying like flies. I myself also got a typhoid, very badly. And what was extremely painful to me is to watch that friend of mine who saved my life, who helped me such a lot in the very beginning and later on. He also got typhoid, but I could not save his life. That was to me exceptionally painful, and I can never forget that experience. And the reason why he succumbed to death. He didn't show any fight, any will to live, because that was just after the liberation. Because, he said, his wife and children are dead, he said. He knows that. There's no point for me to live, he said. I've lost everything. See, I tried to reason with him, I tried to do anything, but he was an exceptionally strong character, and there was nothing I could do to convince him otherwise. I mean, he was a realist. And that's, he was able to help me, but I am afraid I could not help him. And this is something, most unforgettable experience of my life. Anyway, we were taken, when the Russians came in, of course, they liberated us in Theresienstadt. And they took us into the hospitals, improvised hospitals, because there were so many of us ill and dying. And as I say, in those days, they didn't have the intravenous drip like they have now, the saline drip. Or perhaps they didn't know, I don't know. But anyway, didn't get that treatment. It's either you survived or you didn't survive, and that's it. People died in the hospitals just as easily as anywhere else, except at least they were washed, they were cleaned. And they got food, of course they got food, but of course most of people who suffer from typhoid can't eat. They can't even keep fluids down. And so those who survived, and those who didn't, didn't. And it was an extremely, unfortunate, I couldn't enjoy the liberation because I was so weak and so ill, I couldn't enjoy it. Other people, unfortunately, who were not ill with the disease, well, a few people were not, of course. They at least could enjoy. They went out, straight out, and of course managed to get food and really take part in this rejoicing. Because after all, it's one of the greatest moments of your life. I mean, to survive such a terrible, diabolical thing, such a Holocaust, to survive that, I mean, is something beyond one's imagination. I never imagined, I never could believe, when I really thought honestly, I never thought that I could survive that. It was just virtually, completely and utterly impossible.
So you've got no memory of the actual day of liberation?
Yes, the 10th of May.
What was the picture of the liberation when the troops came in?
Which way do you mean? You mean the picture of...
Can you paint a picture of what it was like when the Red Army came in?
Well, I can't visualize it properly because I tell you why, because I was so ill, But obviously the people were rejoicing. From what I could vaguely see through the window, I could just comprehend in my weak state. But I could see, and also some of the inmates and the people in the city, I could see they were very, very joyful, of course. It was a tremendous joy.
Was revenge taken against the people responsible?
I know, I didn't witness anything, but all I do know is that the German guards, for example, they disappeared in thin air in no time at all. They disappeared even the night before. So that's how we knew it was finished. even before the Allies came in. See, they were very shrewd. They had their plan organized to save their own skin. And unfortunately, not many people, not as many people as should have been caught, have been caught, who took part in this diabolical.
Can you describe how you recovered?
Yes, it took me quite a while. And luckily, I remember, even in hospital when I was there, I remember everybody was getting a hard-boiled egg. And of course, I ate my hard-boiled egg, and when I was getting better already, what I needed was something, a clean wash, drinking clean water again, and having some clothes on, because I had no clothes on, because when you suffer from typhoid, of course, it's a terrible thing. You've got this diarrhea and everything. And my morale was boosted, so maybe that helped me a bit to recover quicker. And also, you reach a point, I suppose, when either you survive or you don't. And I remember eventually when I got better in that hospital after a few days, I was able to eat my egg, and I was also able to eat some eggs of people who were dying. They were dying, they couldn't even look at the egg, never mind eat it. So I was able to eat another egg, and so it helped me to recover quicker.
How did you leave Czechoslovakia for England?
Well, after a reasonable time, we were approached, and they said, so many people, would you like to go to Palestine? He says, yes, certainly we want to go to Palestine. But of course, the difficulty, we all registered, we're going to Palestine. But at that time, of course, you couldn't get entrance to Palestine. So so the Jewish Refugee Committee came along, and they managed to get permission from the British authorities to allow in so many people into Britain. And so, of course, we, I think, came over, I think, just over 300. And we came over in August 1945, in I think, 20 Lancaster bombers brought us over. And, of course, that was the happiest moment of our lives, when we came over here to Windermere. I think it was around about 7:30 we arrived in Windermere. And we couldn't believe our eyes. We all got a bed of our own. It was military barracks, you know, in Windermere, which were used by the army during the war. And a clean bed with sheets, with white sheets. And the first thing we were served was trifle. I don't think anything has ever tasted so wonderful in all my lives. And of course, the hospitality of the people, especially in Windermere and also in Manchester, this was tremendous. The people were very, very understanding and very helpful, because we needed a lot of time to readjust ourselves to normal sort of life, because we were not easy people at that time, after living through what we did. And luckily, of course, the Jewish Refugee Committee did a lot of good work for us to rehabilitate us. We stayed in our hostel here in Manchester, in Singleton Road.
In where?
Singleton Road. And we had some very good mentors, good teachers and good people looking after us. They must have had tremendous great difficulty looking after us. And they did a wonderful job and got us back to a civilized state.
Now, going back to the earlier story, can you tell me if the prisoners ever had any organization amongst themselves?
Not what I can remember, no. You see, I think you also had to be careful. You also had to be careful. You didn't know if you were talking to anybody, if somebody was listening in, or you didn't even know who was a plant. You had to be extremely careful.
Did you ever discover any plants?
No. We never knew.
Did you ever come across prisons being experimented on?
Yes. I remember in Auschwitz, friends of mine who were in the same barrack were taken away to be experimented on. Two twins. One was a man on his own. I don't know how old he was. A bit older than me, I think he was. He may have been 20, I'm not sure, or 21 or so. But the twins were my age, and they were experimented on, and of course they will suffer the rest of their lives. They did some most stupid experiments on these people. Very painful. I remember when they came back after the experiments, they were in terrible pain. And this is sort of joy Dr. Mengele derived from. They just enjoyed inflicting maximum pain on people. It was just part of their sport. Because I don't think these laws were laid down by the authorities in Berlin. They just decided that some place, they decided we're going to do this and we're going to do that. After all, we can do what we like with these people.
Do you know what experiments were performed?
Yes, well, in some cases, of course, on the boys. They were experimenting, for example, with the eyes, and they were experimenting with taking eyes out. They were also experimenting with the changing colour of the eyes. And this other fellow, I remember, I think one testicle was removed. And things like that. And I believe they did other experiments on the women, but of course I wasn't in the women's camp, so I don't know the details so much about that. But of course they did even more terrible, more painful experiments on the women.
How did prisoners behave towards each other in the camps? Did they cooperate or compete with each other?
Well, up to a point, there was sometimes cooperation. Yes, there was sometimes cooperation. And other times, there was competition. Obviously, when a person is starving most of the time, he's thinking of himself, I suppose. He's got to be quick. And if there's an opportunity, he's got to grab it. Or he hopes. He's always hopeful he's going to be able to grab it. So he's always got to be alert and somehow or other. Even that state of mind, as we were, he still got. There were some people who were luckier, of course, than others, who were able to be more alert than others.
You said that earlier that you thought that the worst time was in Auschwitz, but from your account, the worst thing to me sounded that rail journey.
Yes, yeah, that's quite true. The rail journey was the worst, there's no question. Because there you had no latitude of any kind. You couldn't do anything to change the situation in any way or form, in the slightest detail. And as I say, when you get no water and no food, and you live in such cramped conditions for a few weeks, this was very bad, very bad. I mean, although people died perhaps in similar numbers in Auschwitz during a similar period, but at least the discomfort and the pain there was all the time on the wagons.
Did the prisoner experience that you've had leave any long-term effects with you?
I think it has, yes, I think it has. First of all, I've got, I get a lot of nightmares. And you worry a lot, and you suffer from lack of confidence. And I've also got two big ulcers. And God knows what else has left me. In fact, it's left a tremendous mark on me. Yeah, I can never forget, for example, the faces of people that I knew very well, my dear brothers, my younger brothers, my sister, my parents. I can never forget that. This is something that people's lives at such a tender age were murdered. Such innocent people. And I ask myself sometimes, why did I have a chance to survive? These people were even more innocent than I was. They were young. They hardly ever said anything wrong in their lives. You know, they haven't did anything in their lives, and these people had to perish. Such innocent lives.
Has it changed your attitudes towards life?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'm a great judge on that, but I'm sometimes a bit suspicious, sceptical. But the interesting thing is, I don't hate. I don't believe in hatred, because I know how bad this particular human indulgence is. It's the most negative, soul-destroying, and I don't even hate the German people. I know millions of them took part in this dirty work, but nevertheless, I do not hate the German people. I can't forget it. I never will forget it. I can't forgive them for it. How can I forgive them? After all, it's the people, the dead people are not here to forgive them. I can't forgive them on behalf of these people who perished. It's not for me. I mean, the ultimate crime was the murder of those people. That was the greatest crime. I would like to introduce one particular experience we had in Auschwitz, for example. We were supposed to work 6 days a week. Because after all, the foremen and the Germans themselves, they want a day off as well. But they had a way out to make sure we did not have a day off. So the seventh day, they gave us punishment work to do. And that was to carry stones from one heap to another heap and then back again. Just to make sure we do not have any day of rest. And of course, always Sundays was also usually used for selections as well. We never got a chance to have a minute's peace. And we never got bored. We always were kept on our toes and always in fear. Every minute of your life was always in fear. And you didn't know when is going to be your next moment and what's going to happen the next day. I also remember when they used to send you to the Lausung. The Lausung means to be deliced. And you were taken along to this place and all your clothes was taken from you. And you got wet trunks in very cold weather. Got wet trunks, you had to put on these wet trunks and run back to your barracks in that condition. We were, we suffered from vermin of all kinds and also skin diseases. You can imagine when you live under such conditions, no soap, no warm water, and the conditions we lived under were absolutely terrible. We were, for example, there were three layers of bunks, and on each layer there were about eight people to each layer. Five people, I can't remember the exact number. And the conditions were absolutely atrocious, on bare boards. And of course, and the cold, we had no heating, and the bitter cold, and the bitter cold at work. I remember we went to work in Stuttgart doing quarrying, and there it was so bitterly cold that no blasting could take place. The rock would not budge, and yet we were made to stand outside and taken to work in those bitter conditions, and with very, very little clothing and hardly any food in your stomach. It's just indescribable.